The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today from the New Yorker Archives, I'll read a story by Atul Gawande. According to New York editor Aaron Overby, Gawande, like Poe, like Edgar Allan Poe, encounters an otherwise common condition and interrogates it on a deeper level, uncovering hidden aspects of our corporeal selves and illuminating the maladies that we're unwilling to face on our own. And following that, if we have time, I'll read a review about Steve Inskeep's new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. And now, from the Annals of Medicine section of the June 30th, 2008 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Itch. Its mysterious power may be a clue to a new theory about brains and bodies, by Atul Gawande. It was still shocking to M how much a few wrong turns could change your life. She had graduated from Boston College with a degree in psychology, married at 25, and had two children, a son and a daughter. She and her family settled in a town on Massachusetts' southern shore. She worked for 13 years in healthcare, becoming the director of a residence program for men who'd suffered severe head injuries. But she and her husband began fighting. There were betrayals. By the time she was 32, her marriage had disintegrated. In the divorce, she lost possession of their home, and amid her financial and psychological struggles, she saw that she was losing her children, too. Within a few years, she was drinking. She began dating someone, and they drank together. After a while, he brought some drugs home, and she tried them. The drugs got harder. Eventually, they were doing heroin, which turned out to be readily available from a street dealer to a block away from her apartment. One day, she went to see a doctor because she wasn't feeling well and learned that she had contracted HIV from a contaminated needle. She had to leave her job. She lost visiting rights with her children. And she developed complications from the HIV, including shingles, which caused painful, blistering sores across her scalp and forehead. With treatment, though, her HIV was brought under control. At 36, she entered rehab, dropped the boyfriend, and kicked the drugs. She had two good years, good quiet years, in which she began rebuilding her life. And then she got the itch. It was right after a shingles episode. The blisters and the pain responded, as they usually did, to acyclovir, an antiviral medication. But this time, the area of the scalp that was involved became numb, and the pain was replaced by a constant, relentless itch. She felt it mainly on the right side of her head. It crawled along her scalp, and no matter how much she scratched, it would not go away. I felt like my inner self, like my brain itself was itching, she says. And it took over her life just as she was starting to get it back. Her internist didn't know what to make of the problem. Itching is an extraordinarily common symptom. All kinds of dermatological conditions can cause it. Allergic reactions, bacterial or fungal infections, skin cancer, psoriasis, dandruff, scabies, lice, poison ivy, sun damage, or just dry skin. Creams and makeup can cause itch, too, but M used ordinary shampoo and soap, no creams. And when the doctor examined M's scalp, she discovered nothing abnormal. No rash, no redness, no scaling, no thickening, no fungus, no parasites. All she saw was scratch marks. The internist prescribed a medicated cream, but it didn't help. The urge to scratch was unceasing and irresistible. Oh, I would try to control it during the day when I was aware of the itch, but it was really hard, M said. At night, it was the worst. I guess I would scratch when I was asleep because in the morning there would be blood on my pillowcase. She began to lose her hair over the itchy area. and she returned to her internist again and again. I just kept haunting her and calling her, M said. But nothing the internist tried worked, and she began to suspect that the itch had nothing to do with M's skin. Now, plenty of non-skin conditions can cause itching. Dr. Jeffrey Bernhard, a dermatologist with the University of Massachusetts Medical School, is among the few doctors to study itching systematically. He published the definitive textbook on the subject. And he told me of cases caused by hyperthyroidism, iron deficiency, liver disease, and cancers like Hodgkin's lymphoma. Sometimes the syndrome is very specific. Persistent outer arm itching that worsens in sunlight is known as brachioradial pruritus, and it's caused by a crimped nerve in the neck. Aquagenic pruritus is recurrent intense diffuse itching upon getting out of a bath or shower. And although no one knows the mechanism, it's a symptom of polycythemia vera, a rare condition in which the body produces too many red blood cells. But M's itch was confined to the right side of her scalp. Her viral count showed that the HIV was quiescent. Additional blood tests and x-rays were normal. So the internist concluded that M's problem was probably psychiatric. All sorts of psychiatric conditions can cause itching. Patients with psychosis can have cutaneous delusions, a belief that their skin is infested with, say, parasites or crawling ants or laced with tiny bits of fiberglass. Severe stress and other emotional experiences can also give rise to a physical symptom like itching, whether from the body's release of endorphins, natural opioids, which, like morphine, can cause itching, increased skin temperature, nervous scratching, or increased sweating. In M's case, the internist suspected trichotillomania, an obsessive-compulsive disorder in which patients have an irresistible urge to pull out their hair. While M was willing to consider such possibilities, her life had been a mess after all. But the antidepressant medications often prescribed for OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, made no difference. And she didn't actually feel a compulsion to pull out her hair. She simply felt itchy on the area of her scalp that was left numb from the shingles. Although she could sometimes distract herself from it by, like, watching television or talking with a friend, the itch did not fluctuate with her mood or level of stress. The only thing that came close to offering relief was to scratch. Scratching is one of the sweetest gratifications of nature and as ready at hand as any, Montaigne wrote. But repentance follows too annoyingly close at its heels. For M, certainly it did. The itching was so torturous and the area so numb that her scratching began to go through the skin. At a later office visit, her doctor found a silver dollar patch size patch of scalp where her skin had been replaced by scab. M tried bandaging her head, wearing caps to bed, but her fingernails would always find a way to her flesh, especially while she slept. One morning, after she was awakened by her bedside alarm, she sat up and she recalled, "This fluid came down my face, this greenish liquid." And she pressed a square of gauze to her head and went to see her doctor again. M showed the doctor the fluid on the dressing. The doctor looked closely at the wound. She shined a light on it and in M's eyes. And then she walked out of the room and called an ambulance. Only in the emergency department at Massachusetts General Hospital, after the doctor started swarming and one told her she needed surgery now, did M learn what had happened. She had scratched through her skull during the night and all the way into her brain. Itching is a most peculiar and diabolical sensation. The definition offered by the German physician Samuel Hefenreffer in 1660 has yet to be improved upon. Quote, an unpleasant sensation that provokes the desire to scratch, end quote. Itch has been ranked by scientific and artistic observers alike among the most distressing physical sensations one can experience. In Dante's Inferno, falsifiers were punished by, quote, the burning rage, a fierce itching that nothing could relieve, end quote. It goes on, the way their nails scraped down upon the scabs was like a knife scraping off scales from carp. Oh, you there tearing at your mail of scabs and even turning your fingers into pincers. My guide began addressing one of them. Tell us, are there Italians among the souls down in this hole? And I'll pray that your nails will last you in this task eternally. Though scratching can provide momentary relief, it often makes the itching worse. Dermatologists call this the itch-scratch cycle. Scientists believe that itch and the accompanying scratch reflex evolved in order to protect us from insects and clinging plant toxins, from such dangers as malaria, yellow fever, and dengue transmitted by mosquitoes, from tularemia, river blindness, and sleeping sickness transmitted by flies, from typhus-bearing lice, plague-bearing fleas, and poisonous spiders. The theory goes a long way toward explaining why itch is so exquisitely tuned. You can spend all day without noticing the feel of your shirt collar on your neck, and yet a single stray thread poking out or a louse's fine legs brushing by can set you scratching furiously. But how exactly itch works has been a puzzle. For most of medical history, scientists thought that itching was merely a weak form of pain. For most of medical history, scientists thought that itching was merely a weak form of pain. Then, in 1987, the German researcher H. O. Handwerker and his colleagues used mild electric pulses to drive histamine, an itch-producing substance that the body releases during allergic reactions, into the skin of volunteers. As the research increased the dose of histamine, they found that they were able to increase the intensity of itch the volunteers reported, from the barely appreciable to the maximum imaginable. Yet, the volunteers never felt an increase in pain. The scientists concluded that itch and pain are entirely separate sensations transmitted along different pathways. Despite centuries spent mapping the body's nervous circuitry, scientists had never noticed a nerve specific for itch. But now the hunt was on, and a group of Swedish and German researchers embarked upon a series of tricky experiments. They inserted ultra-thin metal electrodes into the skin of paid volunteers and wiggled them around until they picked up electrical signals from a single nerve fiber. Computers subtracted the noise from other nerve fibers crossing through the region. The researchers would then spend hours, as long as the volunteer could tolerate it, testing different stimuli on the skin in the area, a heated probe, for example, or a fine paintbrush, to see what would get the nerve to fire, and what the person experienced when it did. They worked their way through 53 volunteers. Mostly they encountered well-known types of nerve fibers that respond to temperature or light touch or mechanical pressure. That feels warm, a volunteer might say, or that feels soft, or ouch, hey. Several times, the scientists came across a nerve fiber that didn't respond to any of these stimuli. When they introduced a tiny dose of histamine into the skin, however, they observed a sharp electrical response in some of these nerve fibers, and the volunteer would experience an itch. They announced their discovery in a 1997 paper. They'd found a type of nerve that was specific for itch. Unlike, say, the nerve fibers for pain, each of which covers a millimeter-sized territory, a single itch fiber can pick up an itchy sensation more than 3 inches away. The fibers also turned out to have extraordinarily low conduction speeds, which explained why itchiness is so slow to build and so slow to subside. Other researchers traced these fibers to the spinal cord and all the way to the brain. examining functional PET scan studies in healthy human subjects who have been given mosquito bite-like histamine injections, they found a distinct signature of itch activity. Several specific areas of the brain light up. The part of the cortex that tells you where on your body the sensation occurs. The region that governs your emotional responses, reflecting the disagreeable nature of the itch. And the limbic and motor areas that process irresistible urges, such as the urge to use drugs among the addicted or to overeat among the obese, reflecting the ferocious impulse to scratch. Now, various phenomena became clear. Itch, it turns out, is indeed inseparable from the desire to scratch. It can be triggered chemically by the saliva injected when a mosquito bites, say, or mechanically from the mosquito's legs even before it bites. The itch-scratch reflex activates higher levels of your brain than the spinal cord level reflex that makes you pull your hand away from a flame. Brain scans also show that scratching diminishes activity in brain areas associated with unpleasant sensation. But some basic features of itch remain unexplained, features that make itch a uniquely revealing case study. On the one hand, our bodies are studded with receptors for itch, as they are with receptors for touch, pain, and other sensation. This provides an alarm system for harm and allows us to safely navigate the world. But why does a feather brushed across the skin sometimes itch and at other times tickle? Tickling has a social component. You can make yourself itch, but only another person can tickle you. And even more puzzling, how is it that you can make yourself itchy just by thinking about it? Contemplating what it's like to hold your finger in a flame won't make your finger hurt. But simply writing about a tick crawling up the nape of one's neck is enough to start my neck itching, and then my scalp. And then this one little spot along my flank where I'm beginning to wonder whether I should check to see if there might be something there. In one study, a German professor of psychosomatics gave a lecture that included, in the first half, a series of what might be called itchy slides, showing fleas, lice, people scratching, and the like. And in the second half, more benign slides, with pictures of soft down, baby skin, bathers. Video cameras recorded the audience. Sure enough, the frequency of scratching among people in the audience increased markedly during the first half and decreased during the second half. Thoughts made them itch. We now have the nerve map for itching, as we do for other sensations. But a deeper puzzle remains. How much of our sensations and experiences do nerves really explain? In the operating room, a neurosurgeon washed out and debrided M's wound, which had become infected. Later, a plastic surgeon covered it with a graft of skin from her thigh. Though her head was wrapped in layers of gauze and she did all she could to resist the still furious itchiness, she awoke one morning to find that she had rubbed the graft away. The doctors returned her to the operating room for a second skin graft, and this time they wrapped her hands as well. She rubbed it away again anyway. "Well, they kept telling me I had OCD," M said. A psychiatric team was sent in to see her each day, and the resident would ask her, "As a child, when you walked down the street, did you count the lines? Did you do anything repetitive? Did you have to count everything you saw?" She kept telling him no, but he seemed skeptical. He tracked down her family and asked them, but they said no, too. Psychology tests likewise ruled out obsessive-compulsive disorder. They showed depression, though, and of course, there was the history of addiction. So the doctors still thought her scratching was from a psychiatric disorder. They gave her drugs that made her feel low-G and sleep a lot. But the itching was as bad as ever, and she still woke up scratching at that terrible wound. One morning, she found, as she put it, this very bright and happy-looking woman standing by my bed. She said, "I'm Dr. Oaklander," M recalled. I thought, "Oh, great, here we go again." But she explained that she was a neurologist, and she said, "The first thing I want to say to you is that I don't think you're crazy. I don't think that you have OCD." At that moment, I really saw her grow wings and a halo, M told me. I said, "Are you sure?" And she said, "Yes, I have heard of this before." Ann Louise Oaklander was about the same age as M. Her mother is a prominent neurologist at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York, and she'd followed her into the field. Oaklander had specialized in disorders of peripheral nerve sensation, disorders like shingles. And although pain is the most common symptom of shingles, Oaklander had noticed during her training that some patients also had itching, occasionally severe, and seeing M reminded her of one of her shingles patients. I remember standing in a hallway talking to her and what she complained about. Her major concern was that she was tormented by this terrible itch over the eye where she had had shingles, she told me. When Oaklander looked at her, she thought that something wasn't right. It took a moment to realize why. The itch was so severe she had scratched off her eyebrow. Oaklander tested the skin near M's wound. It was numb to temperature, touch, and pinprick. Nonetheless, it was itchy. And when it was scratched or rubbed, M felt the itchiness temporarily subside. Oaklander injected a few drops of local anesthetic into the skin. To M's surprise, the itching stopped instantly and almost entirely. This was the first real relief she'd had in more than a year. It was an imperfect treatment, though. The itch came back when the anesthetic wore off, and although Oaklander tried having M wear an anesthetic patch over the wound, the effect diminished over time. Oaklander did not have an explanation for any of this. When she took a biopsy of the itchy skin, it showed that 96% of the nerve fibers were gone. So why was the itch so intense? Oaklander came up with two theories. The first was that those few remaining nerve fibers were itch fibers, and with no other fibers around to offer competing signals, they had become constantly active. The second theory was the opposite. The nerves were dead, but perhaps the itch system in M's brain had gone haywire, running on a loop of all of its own. The second theory seemed less likely. If the nerves to her scalp were dead, how would you explain the relief she got from scratching or from the local anesthetic? Indeed, how could you explain the itch in the first place? An itch without nerve endings didn't make sense. The neurosurgeon stuck with the first theory. They offered to cut the main sensory nerve to the front of M's scalp and abolish the itching permanently. Oaklander, however, thought that the second theory was the right one, that this was a brain problem, not a nerve problem, and that cutting the nerve would do more harm than good. She argued with the neurosurgeons, and she advised M not to let them do any cutting. "But I was desperate," M told me. She let them operate on her, slicing the supraorbital nerve above the right eye. When she woke up, a whole section of her forehead was numb, and the itching was gone. A few weeks later, however, it came back in an even wider expanse than before. The doctors tried pain medications, more psychiatric medications, more local anesthetic. But the only thing that kept M from tearing her skin and skull open again, the doctors found, was to put a foam football helmet on her head and bind her wrist to the bed rails at night. She spent the next 2 years committed to a locked medical ward in a rehabilitation hospital because, although she was not mentally ill, she was considered a danger to herself. Eventually, the staff worked out a solution that did not require binding her to the bed rails. Along with the football helmet, she had to wear white mitts that were secured around her wrist by surgical tape. Every bedtime it looked like they were dressing me up for Halloween. Me and the guy next to me, she told me. The guy next to you? I asked. He had had shingles on his neck, she explained, and also developed a persistent itch. Well, every night they would wrap up his hands and wrap up mine. She spoke more softly now. But I heard he ended up dying from it because he scratched into his carotid artery. I met M several years after she'd been discharged from the rehabilitation hospital. She is 48 now. She lives in a three-room apartment with a crucifix and a bust of Jesus on the wall and the low yellow light of table lamps strung with beads over their shades. Stacked in a wicker basket next to her coffee table were Rick Warren's The Purpose-Driven Life, People, and the latest issue of Neurology Now, a magazine for patients. Together, they summed up her struggles, for she is still fighting the meaninglessness, the isolation, and the physiology of her predicament. She met me at the door in a wheelchair. The injury to her brain had left her partially paralyzed on the left side of her body. She remains estranged from her children. She has not, however, relapsed into drinking or drugs. Her HIV remains under control. Although the itch on her scalp and forehead persists, she has gradually learned to protect herself. She trims her nails short. She finds ways to distract herself. If she must scratch, she tries to rub gently instead. And if that isn't enough, she uses a soft toothbrush or a rolled-up terry cloth. I don't use anything sharp, she said. The 2 years that she spent bound up in the hospital seemed to have broken the nighttime scratching. At home, she found that she didn't need to wear the helmet and gloves anymore. But still, the itching remains a daily torment. Well, I don't normally tell people this, she said, but I have a fantasy of shaving off my eyebrow and taking a metal wire grill brush and scratching away. Some of her doctors have not been willing to let go of the idea that this has been a nerve problem all along. A local neurosurgeon told her that the original operation to cut the sensory nerve to her scalp must not have gone deep enough. He wants me to go in again, she told me. A new scientific understanding of perception has emerged in the past few decades, and it has overturned classical, centuries-long beliefs about how our brains work, though it has apparently not penetrated the medical world yet. The old understanding of perception is what neuroscientists call the naive view, and it is the view that most people in or out of medicine still have. We're inclined to think that people normally perceive things in the world directly. We believe that the hardness of a rock, the coldness of an ice cube, the itchiness of a sweater are picked up by our nerve endings, transmitted through the spinal cord like a message through a wire, and decoded by the brain. In a 1710 treatise concerning the principles of human knowledge, the Irish philosopher George Berkeley objected to this view. We do not know the world of objects, he argued. We know only our mental ideas of objects. Quote, light and colors, heat and cold, extension and figures, in a word, the things we see and feel, what are they but so many sensations, notions, ideas? Indeed, he concluded, the objects of the world are likely just inventions of the mind, put in there by God. To which Samuel Johnson famously responded by kicking a large stone and declaring, I refute it thus. Still, Berkeley had recognized some serious flaws in the direct perception theory, in the notion that when we see, hear, or feel, we are just taking in the sights, sounds, and textures of the world. For one thing, it cannot explain how we experience things that seem physically real but aren't. Sensations of itching that arise from nothing more than itchy thoughts, dreams that can seem indistinguishable from reality, phantom sensations that amputees have in their missing limbs. And the more we examine the actual nerve transmissions we receive from the outside world, the more inadequate they seem. Our assumption had been that the sensory data we receive from our eyes, ears, nose, fingers, and so on contain all the information that we need for perception, and that perception must work something like a radio. It's hard to conceive that a Boston Symphony Orchestra concert is in a radio wave, but it is. So you might think that that's the same with the signals we receive, that if you hooked up someone's nerves to a monitor, you could watch what that person is experiencing as if it were a television show. Yet, as scientists said about analyzing the signals, they found them to be radically impoverished. Suppose someone is viewing a tree in a clearing. Given simply the transmissions along the optic nerve from the light entering the eye, one would not be able to reconstruct the three-dimensionality or the distance or the detail of the bark, attributes that we perceive instantly. Or consider what neuroscientists call the binding problem. Tracking a dog as it runs behind a picket fence, all that your eyes receive is separated vertical images of the dog with large slices missing. Yet somehow you perceive the mutt to be whole, an intact entity traveling through the space. Put two dogs together behind the fence, and you don't think that they've morphed into one. Your mind now configures the slices as two independent creatures. The images in our mind are extraordinarily rich. We can tell if something is liquid or solid, heavy or light, dead or alive. But the information we work from is poor, a distorted two-dimensional transmission with entire spots missing. So the mind fills in most of the picture. You can get a sense of this from brain anatomy studies. If visual sensations were primarily received rather than constructed by the brain, you'd expect that most of the fibers going to the brain's primary visual cortex would come from the retina. Instead, scientists have found that only 20% do. 80% come downward from regions of the brain governing functions like memory. Richard Gregory, a prominent British neuropsychologist, estimates that visual perception is more than 90% memory and less than 10% sensory nerve signals. When Oaklander theorized that M's itch was endogenous rather than generated by peripheral nerve signals, she was on to something important. The fallacy of reducing perception to reception is especially clear when it comes to phantom limbs. Doctors have often explained such sensations as a matter of inflamed or frayed nerve endings in the stump, sending aberrant signals to the brain. But this explanation should long ago have been suspect. Efforts by surgeons to cut back on the nerve typically produce the same results that M had when they cut the sensory nerve to her forehead. A brief period of relief, followed by a return of the sensation. Moreover, the feelings people experience in their phantom limbs are far too varied and rich to be explained by the random firings of a bruised nerve. People report not just pain, but also sensations of sweatiness, heat, texture, and a movement in a missing limb. There is no experience people have with real limbs that they do not experience with phantom limbs. They feel their phantom leg swinging, water trickling down a phantom arm, a phantom ring becomes too tight for a phantom digit. Children have used phantom fingers to count and solve arithmetic problems. V.S. Ramachandran, an eminent neuroscientist at the University of California, San Diego, has written up the case of a woman who was born with only stumps at her shoulders, and yet, as far back as she could remember, she felt herself to have arms and hands. She even feels herself gesticulating when she speaks. And phantoms do not occur just in limbs. Around half the women who have undergone a mastectomy experience a phantom breast, with the nipple being the most vivid part. You've likely had an experience of a phantom sensation yourself. When the dentist gives you a local anesthetic and your lip goes numb, the nerves go dead. Yet you don't feel your lip disappear. Quite the opposite. It feels larger and plumper than normal, even though you can see in a mirror that the size hasn't changed. The account of perception that's starting to emerge is what we might call the brain's best guess theory of perception. Perception is the brain's best guess about what is happening in the outside world. The mind integrates scattered, weak, rudimentary signals from a variety of sensory channels, information from past experiences, and hardwired processes, and produces a sensory experience full of brain-provided color, sound, texture, and meaning. We see a friendly yellow Labrador bounding behind a picket fence, not because that is the transmission we receive, but because this is the perception our weaver brain assembles as its best hypothesis of what is out there from the slivers of information we get. Perception is inference. The theory, and a theory is all it is right now, has begun to make sense of some bewildering phenomena. Among them is an experiment that Ramachandran performed with volunteers who had phantom pain in an amputated arm. They put their surviving arm through a hole in the side of a box with a mirror inside, so that peering through the open top, they would see their arm and its mirror image as if they had two arms. Ramachandran then asked them to move both their intact arm and, in their mind, the phantom arm, to pretend that they were conducting an orchestra, say. The patients had the sense that they had two arms again. Even though they knew it was an illusion, it provided immediate relief. People who for years had been unable to unclench their phantom fists suddenly felt their hand open. Phantom arms in painfully contorted positions could relax. With daily use of the mirror box over weeks, patients sensed their phantom limbs actually shrink into their stumps and in several instances completely vanish. Researchers at Walter Reed Army Medical Center recently published the results of a randomized trial or mirror therapy for soldiers with phantom limb pain, showing dramatic success. A lot about this phenomena remains murky, but here's what the new theory suggests is going on. When your arm is amputated, nerve transmissions are shut off, and the brain's best guess often seems to be that the arm is still there, but paralyzed or clenched or beginning to cramp up. Things can stay like this for years. The mirror box, however, provides the brain with new visual input, however illusory, suggesting motion in the absent arm. The brain has to incorporate the new information into its sensory map of what's happening, and therefore it guesses again, and the pain goes away. The new theory may also explain what was going on with M's itch. The shingles destroyed most of the nerves in her scalp, and for whatever reason, her brain surmised, from what little input it had, that something horribly itchy was going on. That perhaps a whole army of ants were crawling back and forth over just that patch of skin. There wasn't anything, of course, but M's brain has received no contrary signals that would shift its assumptions. So she itches. Not long ago, I met a man who made me wonder whether such phantom sensations are more common than we realize. H was 48, in good health, an officer at a Boston financial services company, living with his wife in a western suburb, when he made passing mention of an odd pain to his internist. For at least 20 years, he said, he'd had a mild tingling running along his left arm and down the left side of his body, and if he tilted his neck forward at a particular angle, it became a pronounced electrical jolt. The internist recognized this as Leidermitte's sign, a classic symptom that can indicate multiple sclerosis, vitamin B12 deficiency, or spinal cord compression from a tumor or herniated disc. An MRI revealed a cavernous hemangioma, a pea-sized mass of dilated blood vessels pressing into the spinal cord in his neck. A week later, while the doctors were still contemplating what to do, it ruptured. I was raking leaves out in the yard, and all of a sudden, there was an explosion of pain, and my left arm wasn't responding to my brain, H said when I visited him at home. Once the swelling subsided, a neurosurgeon performed a tricky operation to remove the tumor from the spinal cord. The operation was successful, but afterward H began experiencing a constellation of strange sensations. His left hand felt cartoonishly large, at least twice its actual size. He developed a constant burning pain along an inch-wide ribbon extending from the left side of his neck all the way down his arm. And an itch crept up and down along the same band, which no amount of scratching would relieve. H has not accepted that these sensations are here to stay. The prospect is too depressing. But they've persisted for 11 years now. Although the burning is often tolerable during the day, the slightest thing that can trigger an excruciating flare-up. A cool breeze across the skin. The brush of a shirt sleeve or a bed sheet. Sometimes I feel that my skin has been flayed and my flesh is exposed, and any touch is just very painful, he told me. Sometimes I feel that there's an ice pick or a wasp sting. Sometimes I feel that I've been splattered with hot cooking oil. For all that, the itch has been the harder to endure. H has developed calluses from in the incessant scratching. I find that I'm choosing itch relief over the pain that I am provoking by satisfying the itch, he said. He has tried all sorts of treatments, medications, acupuncture, herbal medicines, lidocaine injections, electrical stimulation therapy, but nothing really worked, and the condition forced him to retire in 2001. He now avoids leaving the house. He gives himself projects. Last year, he built a 3-foot stone wall around his yard, slowly placing the stones by hand. But he spends much of his day, after his wife has left for work, alone in the house with her 3 cats, his shirt off and the heat turned up, trying to prevent a flare-up. His neurologist introduced him to me, with his permission, as an example of someone with severe itching from a central rather than a peripheral cause. So one morning we sat in his living room trying to puzzle out what was going on. The sun streamed in through a big bay window. One of his cats, a scraggly brown tabby, curled up beside me on the couch. H sat in an armchair in a baggy purple t-shirt he'd put on for my visit. He told me that he thought his problem was basically a, quote, bad switch, end quote, in his neck, where the tumor had been. A kind of loose wire sending false signals to his brain. But I told him about the increasing evidence that our sensory experiences are not sent to the brain, but originate in it. When I got to the example of phantom limb sensations, he perked up. The experiences of phantom limb patients sounded familiar to him. When I mentioned that he might want to try the mirror box treatment, he agreed. I have a mirror upstairs, he said. He brought a Cheval glass down to the living room, and I had him stand with his chest against the side of it so that his troublesome left arm was behind it and his normal right arm was in front. He tipped his head so that when he looked into the mirror, the image of his right arm seemed to occupy the same position as his left arm. Then I had him wave his arms, his actual arms, as if he were conducting an orchestra. The first thing he experienced was disappointment. It isn't quite like looking at my left hand, he said. But then suddenly it was. Wow, he said. Now this is odd. After a moment or two, I noticed that he had stopped moving his left arm. Yet he reported that he still felt as if it were moving. What's more, the sensations in it had changed dramatically. For the first time in 11 years, he felt his left hand snap back to normal size. He felt the burning pain in his arm diminish. And the itch, too, was dulled. This is positively bizarre, he said. He still felt the pain and the itch in his neck and shoulder, where the image in the mirror cut off. And when he came away from the mirror, the aberrant sensations in his left arm returned. He began using the mirror a few times a day, for 15 minutes or so at a stretch, and I checked in with him periodically. What's most dramatic is the change in the size of my hand, he says. After a couple of weeks, his hand returned to feeling normal in size all day long. The mirror also provided the first effective treatment he has had for the flares of itch and pain that sporadically seize him. Where once he could do nothing but sit and wait for the torment to subside, it sometimes took an hour or more. He now just pulls out the mirror. "I've never had anything like this before," he said. "It's my magic mirror." There have been other isolated successes with mirror treatment. In Bath, England, several patients suffering from what is called complex regional pain syndrome, severe disabling limb sensations of unknown cause, were reported to have experienced complete resolution after 6 weeks of mirror therapy. In California, mirror therapy helped stroke patients recover from a condition known as hemineglect, which produces something like the opposite of a phantom limb. These patients have a part of the body they no longer realize is theirs. Such findings open up a fascinating prospect. Perhaps many patients whom doctors treat as having a nerve injury or disease have instead what might be called sensor syndromes. When your car's dashboard warning light keeps telling you that there is an engine failure, but the mechanics can't find anything wrong, the sensor itself may be the problem. This is no less true for human beings. Our sensations of pain, itch, nausea, and fatigue are normally protective. Unmoored from physical reality, however, they become a nightmare. M with her intractable itching and H with his constellation of strange symptoms. But perhaps also the hundreds of thousands of people in the United States who suffer from conditions like chronic back pain, fibromyalgia, chronic pelvic pain, tinnitus, temporomandibular joint disorder, or repetitive strain injury, where typically no amount of imaging, nerve testing, or surgery managed to uncover an anatomical explanation. Doctors have persisted in treating these conditions as nerve or tissue problems, engine failures, as it were. We get under the hood and remove this, replace that, snip some wires, yet still the sensor keeps going off. So we get frustrated. "There's nothing wrong," we will insist. And the next thing you know, we're treating the driver instead of the problem. We prescribe tranquilizers, antidepressants, escalating doses of narcotics. And the drugs often do make it easier for people to ignore the sensors, even if they are wired right into the brain. The mirror treatment, by contrast, targets the deranged sensor system. It essentially takes a misfiring sensor, a warning system functioning under an illusion that something is terribly wrong out in the world that it monitors, and feeds it an alternate set of signals that calm it down. The new signals may even reset the sensor. This may help explain, for example, the success of the advice that back specialists now commonly give. "Work through the pain," they tell many of their patients, and surprisingly often the pain goes away. It had been a mystifying phenomenon, but the picture now seems clearer. Most chronic back pain starts as an acute back pain, say, after a fall. Usually the pain subsides as the injury heals. But in some cases, the pain sensors continue to light up long after the tissue damage is done, is gone. In such instances, working through the pain may offer the brain contradictory feedback, a signal that ordinary activity does not, in fact, cause physical harm, and so the sensor resets. This understanding of sensation points to an entire new array of potential treatments, based not on drugs or surgery, but instead on the careful manipulation of our perceptions. Researchers at the University of Manchester in England have gone a step beyond mirrors and fashioned an immersive virtual reality system for treating patients with phantom limb pain. Detectors transpose movement of real limbs into a virtual world where patients feel they are actually moving, stretching, even playing a ball game. So far, 5 patients have tried the system, and they have all experienced a reduction in pain. Whether those results will last has yet to be established. But the approach raises the possibility of designing similar systems to help patients with other sensor syndromes. How, one wonders, would someone with chronic back pain fare in a virtual world? The Manchester study suggests that there may be many ways to fight our phantoms. I called Ramachandran to ask him about M's terrible itch. The sensation may be a phantom, but it's on her scalp, not in a limb. So it seemed unlikely that his mirror approach could do anything for her. He told me about an experiment in which he put ice-cold water in people's ears. This confuses the brain's position sensors, tricking subjects into thinking that their heads are moving. And in certain phantom limb and stroke patients, the illusion corrected their misperceptions, at least temporarily. Maybe this would help M, he said. He had another idea. If you take two mirrors and put them at right angles to each other, you will get a non-reversed mirror image. Looking in, the right half of your face appears on the left, and the left half appears on the right. But unless you move, he said, your brain may not realize that the image is flipped. Now, suppose she looks in this mirror and scratches the left side of her head. No, wait, I'm thinking out loud here. Suppose she looks and you have someone else touch the left side of her head. It'll feel like you're touching the right side of her head. He let out an impish giggle. Maybe this would make her itchy right scalp feel more normal. Maybe it would encourage her brain to make a different perceptual inference. Maybe it would press reset. Who knows, he said. It seemed worth a try. Well, I'm sorry we don't have enough time left for the piece about Stephen Inskeep's book. And so instead, we'll save that for next time. And instead, I'll read some short pieces from the Talk of the Town. The first one is from the Bench Department, Meet the Lawyers by Laura Lane. An invitation for a cocktail party honoring lawyers, especially highly skilled ones who are about to argue one of the most momentous cases of the year, the next Supreme Court abortion case, tends to read like a legal document. Guests are invited to come and go as they please, noted a message from the Center for Reproductive Rights, a legal advocacy nonprofit. The party was held in the kitchen at the center's offices in a high-rise in the South Street Seaport. The two lead attorneys on medical services, on June Medical Services, LLC, versus G, not quite as catchy as Roe v. Wade, whom attendees had come to meet, Julie Rickelman and TJ Two, talked with guests with such phrases as bogus sham laws and second-class citizens ricocheting around the kitchen island. The two lawyers have been working 70-hour weeks on their case, which will come before the newly conservative court in March. My husband would say I do nothing else successfully in my life at the moment, Two, who wore square spectacles, said. He checked for Sonia Sotomayor in the second, he clerked for Sonia Sotomayor in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and was a co-counsel on a 2014 Supreme Court case on false advertising. He said that he'd reviewed 27 amicus briefs over Thanksgiving while cooking dinner for 13 people. Rickelman, who has shoulder-length brown hair and was dressed all in navy, has a 10-year-old and an 11-year-old who will turn 12 just before the abortion case begins. So I'm going to have to figure out how to host a birthday party for her and then go to the Supreme Court, she said. The two discussed Supreme Court swag. Two keeps the commemorative quill that he was given after the 2014 case in his medicine chest, and the SCOTUS fashion police. We have to wear a blue or gray suit, Rickelman said. There's an entire booklet about it. It gives you a lot of detailed instructions. Even female attorneys who are just there to observe can wear pants only if they wear a matching jacket. Furs and hats are forbidden. The case, which contests a 2014 Louisiana law requiring abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a local hospital, resembles a 2016 Supreme Court case, Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt, concerning a nearly identical Texas law, which the Center for Reproductive Rights won in a 5-3 decision. Pro-choice advocates call these, quote, trap laws for, quote, targeted regulation of abortion providers, end quote, because they are a roundabout way to chip away at abortion rights by throwing up logistical roadblocks. The only difference this time is the composition of the court. It will be the first abortion case since Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch were appointed. It could be a turning point, Nancy Northrup, the center's president and CEO, said, adding that if the court allows that law to go into effect, it would close all but one clinic in Louisiana and openly defy the ruling from 3 years ago. They're essentially saying Roe is still in the books, but anything goes. And she paused. It's a lot of pressure. An hour into the party, only one bottle of wine was empty. A plate of cookies was untouched. This is super tame, Northrup said. She insisted that the center's parties are usually livelier. Competitive in the courtroom translates to competitive on the karaoke stage, competitive at costuming, competitive at dancing. Across the room, two colleagues solemnly discussed the news. The impeachment is really taking attention away, Kelly Krause, the center's press officer, said, adding that she'd had trouble getting reporters to focus on the case. If you take the word abortion out of it, it's a rule of law case that I think is very simple, Jenny Ma, a senior staff attorney, said. They changed the subject to the center's upcoming villain-themed office party. There's an award for best hero-villain combination, Krause said. You could be RBG. A guest suggested that Krause could be Kavanaugh. No one laughed. By 7:30 p.m., two more bottles had been drunk. But this party was just a warm-up. We always do a rally on the Supreme Court steps, Tu said. It's going to be 30 degrees. Instead, of course, he will have to wear blue or gray. But once we're outside, he said, I can put my pussy hat on. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, and I'd love to hear from you, please call 919-832-5138 or send me an email to info@ncreadingservice.org. That's info@ncreadingservice.org. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.